This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Goldrock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, and my name is Darren Rockman, and I'm a partner at Goldrock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing Israeli and foreign families and their wealth and financial needs. And today on the podcast, I am really very, very privileged to have Ambassador Michael Oren. Ambassador Oren, welcome to Definitely Uncertain.
Good to be with you, Darren. Good to be with all of you. Shalom.
Shalom. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining. So, Ambassador Oren does not really need an introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyhow. He served as a lone soldier in the IDF in the paratroopers unit, and then he went on to becoming an IDF spokesman. He was Israeli ambassador to the United States from 2009 to 2013, where he was instrumental in fortifying the U.S.-Israel alliance and obtaining Israeli aid, importantly, including for the Iron Dome system. Post his time in Washington, he served as a member of Knesset, and a deputy minister of diplomacy in the prime minister's office, where he spearheaded efforts to strengthen Israel diaspora relations, to develop the Golan Heights, and to fight BDS around the world. He's the author of several New York Times bestselling books, including 6 Days of War, Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israel Divide and Power, Faith and Fantasy, and he is the founder of the Israel Advocacy Group. Ambassador Oren's latest writings can be found on his Substack Clarity, and we are really, as I said, honored to have him on the podcast. So, Ambassador Oren, let's start with the Israel-U.S. relationship, which has gone through some ups and downs in the time post-October 7th. We saw an incredible amount of support coming from the U.S. And from President Biden personally. But as of late, we are seeing other voices coming out as well, including warnings and signals with regard to Israel's purported operation in Rafah. From your viewpoint as a diplomat and as a historian, how does Israel navigate this sort of treacherous and perhaps unprecedented landscape, including the Democratic Party in the United States?
It is certainly a treacherous landscape and very complex. And navigating the shoals is going to be extremely difficult. Let's put it in some type of context, Darren. The U.S.-Israel relationship is a special relationship. America's closest alliances in the world really rest on two pillars. It would be common democratic values and a shared strategic interest. Australia is a good example of that. Great Britain, France. The Israeli-U.S. relationship rests on three pillars. It's shared democratic values, common strategic interests, and a spiritual tie. America was, and to a large extent remains, the most religiously observant country in the industrialized world. More people go to a church every Sunday in the United States than any other country. Churches in Europe are largely empty, not in the United States still. And people read their Bible, and they know about the relationship between the Jewish people and God, and the Jewish people and this land, and they make conclusions. And that's why you have at least 70 million evangelicals, but it's not just the evangelicals who are strongly pro-Israel. Just a poll taken last week at the height of all the controversy going on in the United States and the campuses, a Harvard University poll showed that 80% of Americans support Israel in this war, and only 20% support Hamas. That's saying something about what the American heartland feels about Israel. Now, having said that, over the course of the last now 76 years since Israel's creation, there have been ups and downs in the U.S.-Israel relationship. It is special, but it also has some very special crises. From 1956, the Suez Crisis, when President Eisenhower threatened to put sanctions on Israel unless Israel withdrew from occupied Sinai. Ups and downs. Ronald Reagan, very pro-Israel president, suspended arms deliveries entirely in 1981 after Israeli jets bombed the Iraqi nuclear reactor. Total ups and downs. I was ambassador during the Obama years, and it was pretty much a crisis every day, a rolling crisis. I got most of this gray hair during that period. So, yes, there have been.
But you did an amazing job.
I'll just quote something that President Obama said to me on my last day in office. I happened to be in the Oval Office, And he said something I'll never forget. He says, should Israel ever find itself in a desperate war with Iran, the United States will always be by Israel's side because, he said, that is what the American people expect. That was interesting. It's not what he expected, but it's what the American people expect. I think the American people still expect that. So a very special relationship. Now, having said all that, as I said before, we are in very treacherous territory and difficult to navigate. It begins with the Biden administration. And I put, cards on the table. I worked with Joe Biden for years. I worked with what who's now Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken. I worked with the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan. I know them personally. They are probably in the Democratic world, probably the three most pro-Israel people I know, deeply committed to the U.S.-Israel alliance, to Israel security. But, and there's several buts. One is they are Democrats, and there is a Democratic traditional policy and a Democratic worldview, which assigns a tremendous amount of respect and credence to the UN and UN agencies, that is not comfortable with use of force on a large scale, which has a very strong feeling about the Palestinians, much stronger than they feel about Afghans or Afghanis or Syrians, Palestinians. And this comes into play. And on top of all that, you have a presidential election, 2024, which is really hinging on six states or as little as two states. We talk about the two-state solution. The two-state solution may be Michigan and Nevada, where you have large, you have younger populations, and we know that that 80% goes down precipitously as you get to people below 35 and certainly below 24. Progressive populations, populations of Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, who have expressed extreme opposition, in some cases more than opposition, to President Biden's support of Israel during this war. And so acting from his gut, and I'd say from their guts, both the president and the Secretary of State Blinken on October 8th to October 10th came out with extraordinary statements. And I've been involved with U.S.-Israel relations for many decades, both as a historian and as a practitioner. And I'd never heard speeches like this. It was quite extraordinary. And both the president and the secretary of state signed on to Israel's goal of destroying Hamas. But they also mentioned, and I think in Israel, I was probably not the only one to pick this up, because they mentioned in about a half a sentence saying that as Israel pursued its military objectives, the United States expected Israel to accord with international humanitarian law. And I thought to myself, oh, there's the clock. It's ticking. Because we're dealing with an enemy who's hiding behind the civilian population, hiding beneath the civilian population, and civilian casualties are going to climb. And at a certain point, the emphasis is going to be from Jewish suffering of October 7th to Palestinian suffering. And I gave it about 2.5 weeks. It was about 2.5 weeks, about a week and a half in Europe, if anybody's in Europe. Remember the day that BBC went over, about a week and a half. And then the Secretary Blinken's line was entirely too many Palestinians have been killed. Kind of a strange line because it assumes that there's a number out there that would have been okay. And how many have been killed? Or Israel's been dehumanizing Palestinians. The president has said that Israel has bombed indiscriminately in Gaza. And everyone in the administration cites the number of casualties that have published by the Hamas Gaza Health Authorities, which is kind of an oxymoron, the Gaza Health Authorities. And we know that that number not only is inflated, but it includes the 13 to 15,000 terrorists that Israel has killed. It includes the thousands of Palestinians who've been killed by Palestinian rockets that have fallen short. About 30% of their rockets fall short. It also includes the actual Palestinians who just die of natural causes over a 7-month period. In a population of 2.5 million, at least 4,000 people will die of natural causes. So if you deduct all of those from the 32,000 or 33,000 that Hamas is claiming, you're going to get close to a 1-to-1 ratio of combatant to civilian, which is at least a quarter of what it was when the United States fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria. So, there's an attempt here on the part of the administration, I think, on one hand, to feel actual sympathy for the Palestinians, but also to try to win a presidential election, which is very, very tight. Most polls still show Donald Trump in the head. So how is Israel supposed to navigate this? Well, we haven't done very well. It is not an easy situation, but then we make it worse. President Biden has asked for Israel to discuss the day after scenario, discuss the possibility of involving what he calls a revamped or revitalized Palestinian Authority in the post-war governance of Gaza. He's asked that Israel discuss a pathway to a Palestinian state, and he's asked for a massive humanitarian aid in Gaza. So let's put my cards on the table and say I'm not a spokesman for the government. I'm a free agent. And I say, you know, we have to dig in our heels when it comes to fighting Hamas. If it means going into Rafah, we have to go into Rafah. But we can meet the president halfway. It costs us nothing to discuss all these things. You can discuss a pathway to a Palestinian state. A pathway, from my perspective, is a thing with gravel and shrubs. You can discuss it. We've been discussing it for years. You can discuss a revitalized Palestinian Authority's role, whatever. But we have to decide what revitalization actually means and what the benchmarks are. And we should actually, I've long since the beginning of the war thought that we should literally flood Gaza with humanitarian aid because Hamas wants dead Palestinians. And by denying aid to the Palestinians, we're actually helping Hamas so that we could do much, much, much better.
So to summarize right now, summarize the way that you're framing it, we have to talk the talk, but independent of that, we have to walk our own walk and do what we think is right militarily within Gaza.
I've had longstanding principles that I, according to which I conduct my diplomacy. One is give in wherever you can give in, if it doesn't cost you anything, if it's just rhetoric. But when it comes to our absolute no margin for error security interests, we don't give an inch. Okay, that's the case, for example, with fighting Hamas. Two, we do whatever we need to do to give time and space to the IDF to fight. Everything else is secondary and tertiary. And so if by saying to the Biden administration, okay, we'll discuss a pathway to the Palestinian state or flooding Hamas with humanitarian aid, we give more time and space to the IDF to act, then I say do it.
Yep.
Always.
Yep. So then if you then widen the lens a little bit and then look at regional concerns, so we have, obviously, Israel has a huge interest in trying to build a strong bridge into Saudi Arabia. The United States are trying to play some type of mediating role here, and obviously the Saudis have their own interest. How do you understand the U.S.'s role in trying to move that forward? And, you know, is this going to be happening at a reasonable pace that we can sort of foresee, or is it just one big open question at the moment?
Well, the Biden administration's policy has been, inconsistent since taking office. For the first several years, the Biden administration actually wouldn't utter the words Abraham Accords because it was, it was tainted with Trump. Right. Netanyahu wasn't invited to the White House. The Saudis were being snubbed. And then there was a very strong sort of about face just over a year ago, when all of a sudden the United States decided it was going to broker a peace agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia. There were many reasons behind this. The Saudis had gravitated into the Chinese and Iranian orbit. The United States had a reason to grab them back. Yeah. Again, a presidential election coming up with no major foreign policy achievements other than a rather humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan. A lot of factors contributed to that. That initiative. I should add that I'm no prophet, but on October 5th, I was giving a talk in Dallas where I told my audience that Israel would soon be going to war. And everyone gasped. And I said, well, it's very obvious to me that the United States is trying to broker this peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia. It has a nuclear component. And if anybody thinks that the Iranians are going to sit by placidly while Saudi Arabia gets a nuclear capability, they're kidding themselves. Iran
maybe
will
start you are a prophet. I'm not sure the prophet we want, right?
and I don't understand why they're going to do it now either. They're talking about, again, a nuclear component. They're also talking about creating a regional defense architecture against Iran.
Yep.
Now, Iran won't like that. I don't think they have much to fear from the United States. The United States has been unwilling to use any counteroffensive measures against Iran, even when pro-Iranian proxies attack American bases in Iraq, Syria, and Jordan over 170 times. Not one American bullet was fired at Iran, fired at the proxies, but not at Iran. So I don't know how much, I don't know whether they actually be the intrinsic value, strategic value of this alliance. But of course, for Israel, a peace with Saudi Arabia is a very attractive package. Because through Saudi Arabia, Israel gets peace not only with much of the Gulf region, but also with the entire Sunni world. It's Indonesia, Malaysia, many, many countries. We're talking about vast markets, even potentially Pakistan. Vast markets opening up. So it's kind of it's a game changer for us, and very attractive. And I think that's one of the reasons that Netanyahu has made what Secretary Blinken has called a very generous offer on the hostage exchange. Reducing our terms from 40 hostages to 33, which may also quite tragically reflect the number of hostages who are alive to be released, extending the ceasefire to 40 days, and releasing a lot of Palestinian prisoners from our prisons, which is going to be excruciatingly painful, particularly for the families of the victims of those prisoners. Go explain to them why, their son and daughter not coming home, but this guy's going to get a hero's welcome somewhere. Very, very difficult. It's yet to be seen whether Hamas will accept it. And here, Darren, I got to just give me a second to explain this. That is, the Biden administration, in its attempt to be more or less even-handed, maintaining support for Israel, giving us ammunition, casting some very important vetoes in the Security Council, recently vetoing an attempt to unilaterally create a Palestinian state. And pushing through a $26 billion aid package through Congress—that's amazing. That's many, many years of aid in one bill. Quite extraordinary. But on the other hand, the administration keeps on saying that Israel has acted in this inhumane manner to the Palestinians, and then saying quite openly, "We will not support an Israeli incursion into Rafah under any circumstances." So, Mr. Sinwar, the head of Hamas, hears this and thinks, "Okay. The time's on my side. All I have to do is dig at my heels, and I don't have to give up." So America has basically undercut its own negotiating position in the hostage negotiations. And because the great leverage which anybody has on Sinwar is the Israeli incursion into Rafah. And if the United States is going to stop it, on my Substack, on this Clarity newsletter, which, by the way, you can subscribe to for free, I had an article last week called The Shield of Palestine, the Shield of David, that talked about the use of human shields, this whole concept of human shields. But it's quite remarkable that both Hamas and the United States are using the Palestinians of Rafah as human shields. The Hamas is using them as physical shields, but the United States is using them as diplomatic shields. Says to Israel, you can't go into Rafah because there's 1.2 million Palestinians there. And so by using, they're basically shielding Sinwar. Sinwar is saying, well, I'm sitting good. I'm sitting behind these shields. And the
So,
United States is not going to support Israel.
right. So, if you're now Sinwar, you're now Hamas. What are your incentives to do a deal?
It
You're
beats me, as they say in Australia. Beats me.
That is what they say in
I don't,
Spain.
I don't, I'm not quite certain. Because Sinwar needs one thing and one thing only. He needs
End of the
an
war.
open and permanent ceasefire that ends the war. Anything less, why would he want to give up a solid asset? So, I mean, you're business people. Why would you give up a solid asset in return for something temporary? And Israel has said, and I think quite rightly, that irrespective of whether we go into either whether we wait a day or we wait 40 days, at the end of the day, we're going to have to send our forces into Rafah and uproot Hamas. We have to, or else we don't win the war. And we can't restore our internal security. We can't restore our regional deterrence. We have to do this. Why would Sinwar agree to that? Unless he has some indication from the United States and the United States, even in Israel, that 40 days will be extended.
Okay, I want to take you back to the Iranian question, and it seems like, months ago, but it was only a couple of weeks back that we had probably one of the scariest nights for Israel, and also one of the most pivotal moments in the Middle East in decades, which was the Iranian attack on Israel, which was followed by a fairly muted response from Israel, from the IDF. I think that there are two vectors here I want you to comment on. The first is the question of the international coalition, overnight coalition, which protected Israel, the United States, Jordan, the United Kingdom, which were all part militarily of shooting down the missiles and projectiles and drones which came at Israel. And the second vector is the critique that we are starting to hear from various parts within Israel about the muted response and whether or not we revealed our hand militarily and strategically in a way which was damaging for very little gain, and whether or not it was the right thing to do. So if you could just sort of give your view on what happened and what the implications are.
Okay, so good. I'm going to pan out again and understand what has happened with Iran in recent years. I can't sugarcoat this in any way. We set out over the course of the last two decades to prevent Iran from getting military nuclear capabilities, and we have not succeeded. Today, Iran is what's known as a threshold state. It can make a nuclear weapon within a matter of weeks, maybe even a matter of days. Only thing that is separating Iran from those military nuclear capabilities is a decision. And everybody knows it. It's why Iran has helped Iran fortify relations with China, with Russia. Iran not too long ago was admitted to the BRIC countries. Everyone is recognizing that Iran is essentially a military nuclear power. It's not quite North Korea, because Iran has concluded that the advantages of almost having a bomb are at least as great as actually having a bomb without any of the disadvantages, right? Because the United States has sworn to prevent Iran from getting a bomb and might try to prevent it from doing so militarily, but the United States has never sworn to prevent Iran from achieving the ability to make a bomb, which is what they have today. But for Israel, it's very, very, very dangerous and impacts our regional defense thinking. For the last 15 years, at least, Israel's played by Iranian rules. So is the United States, but far greater ramifications for Israel. What are the rules? Iran fires at us through its proxies. Hezbollah, Hamas, others. We fire back at the proxies. The proxies hide behind the civilian population. We kill civilians, and we get branded war criminals. And with each round, Iran gets away scot-free. Iran never pays a price, never pays a price. And we had begun to change the rules by eliminating high-ranking officers in the Iranian security establishment, some of them in Damascus in Syria or in Lebanon. And then Iran also changed the rules. By the way, almost nobody predicted that they changed the rules, and certainly the way they changed the rules in such a massive scale. 350 projectiles launched at us. Now, there was spent 48 hours interviewing on the international news, and literally we watched these projectiles coming close to Israel, and there was a conventional wisdom out there that this is just for show. Iran is firing first these slow-moving drones. That's going to warn Israel. It's going to warn all the allies that it's coming, and they'll be able to shoot all these things down. What can I say about that? It was malarkey. As far as I'm concerned, the drones that came first were a detour, were an attempt to to draw off our defenses, but a decoy. They were, they weren't the real blow. The real blow with the cruise missiles, each one carrying 500 kilogram of high explosive, enough to take out an entire neighborhood. Could have killed any one of them. Gotten through, would have been thousands of people killed, not 100,000. Huge, massive missiles, and this was a game changer. It's no longer Iran firing through its proxies. So the good news was that we had an international coalition. We had a coalition of the British, the French, and the United States, plus Arab Sunni allies. Jordan, Saudi Arabia were involved in taking down these missiles, the UAE. The bad news is that there was then tremendous pressure on Israel to respond in a very restrained way. And that pressure, I'm sure, had immediate impact on the prime minister. Reportedly, the three ministers in the government who were most opposed to a restrained response were Mr. Ben-Gvir to the right, but also Benny Gantz and Gabi Eisenkot kind of to the left. And Israel could have struck back by, say, eliminating at least one or two nuclear facilities. But Israel, at this point, I guess, buckled, if you will,
yeah,
or acceded to American pressure. And the response was that the Americans said, not a strike, but a message. And the message, I think, was a good message, which is we could hit you, Iran, anywhere, anytime. You can't stop us. But will it be enough to actually deter Iran? At the end of the day, the proof is deterrence. And we don't know. And we don't know. And we cannot totally eliminate the possibility that at some point these very large cruise missiles will carry a non-conventional warhead. And then the price of failing to intercept that one will skyrocket. And again, it impacts our overall deterrence and strategic view. And the future here is very uncertain. America's talking about this regional deterrence architecture. But again, it will be only defensive and not offensive and not involved in deterrence. The United States was able to create NATO in the aftermath of World War II. The United States fought very much on the counteroffensive. And then in Korea and then in Vietnam again. Now, the United States now for a decade has refused to take on offensive capabilities just about anywhere. And so we have to be very cautious in going into the architecture. On one hand, it's great to have American defenses and have Saudis and the Jordanians under one umbrella. That's great. But that alliance can never tie our hands. We cannot outsource our fundamental security to any organizations or any country. And our ability to strike back is actually going to be crucial for our deterrence.
Yeah. Well, some might argue that that ability to act independently has already gone, and that the response or the tepid response to the Iranian missile attack on Israel was a prime example of that. Israel being forced into a box that perhaps its defense establishment weren't that comfortable with, and many of its policymakers weren't that comfortable with.
Well, one of the great revelations, it's more like a realization that occurred on October 7th, is the degree to which the United States is so dependent, Israel is so dependent on the United States, and the degree to which we have outsourced our fundamental security and our maneuverability. The depth of our dependence on American munitions. Now, again, cards on the table. Sorry if you're using that the metaphor all the time. Back in 2016, when I was in government, I was the only Israeli first member of that government to oppose the Obama MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, which was a 10-year, $4 billion a year program in aid. Now, I have many reasons why I oppose U.S. aid. I want U.S. and Israel to be partners in cyber security and laser technology and other areas. I don't want handouts. And there are many reasons for this, but one of the reasons was dependability and independence, sorry. And that that in wartime, predicted that when wartime comes, we're gonna find ourselves, you know, basically at the behest of the United States. And if we have a situation. And I was acting out of experience. I'd come in 2014. This is precisely what happened. The Obama administration and the war with Gaza said we were killing too many Palestinians. Every single round, they said we were killing too many Palestinians. It stopped us every time. And Obama actually held up the supply of certain vital munitions for the first time.
Yes.
So I was operating on that assumption that this could happen again. And now it's happening again. Yesterday, 88 members of Congress voted to perhaps suspend American military aid to Israel in view of our conduct of the Gaza war. And if you would have asked the Israelis on October 6th, can Israel defend itself by itself against any Middle Eastern threat? I think 95% of Israelis would have said yes. The same 95% would have accepted no the next day as President Biden not only sent arms here, but sent two carrier strike groups to this area to help defend us. So I think one of the great revelations has been that we cannot afford to be this dependent on any power, even the benevolent United States. It's not consonant with our sovereignty, and it's certainly not constructive in terms of our ability to defend ourselves by ourselves and have that type of maneuverability. So I think one of the outcomes of this war will be serious steps to reduce our dependency on the United States.
Okay. I want to switch now to U.S. campuses, which have been the focus of so much in the media over the last couple of weeks. You're a Columbia University alumni yourself, you have a direct connection there. But the anti-Israel and anti-Semitic unrest at universities, let's talk about how that's being funded. And you've called on the FBI to investigate the money trail behind this. Where does it lead? How much of this is campus radicals, and how much of this is really organized by an outside actor?
I was asked by the, there's actually an organization, the Jewish Alumni of Columbia University. I was asked to represent them in the press toward the Congress. And it was in that framework that I made the call to the president to have the protesters investigated. Clearly, they were being organized and funded from outside. If you just have to look at the pictures and look at all the tents, they're all the same tents, same flags. By the way, it was on different campuses. The phenomenon of the protesters is a very deep, multifaceted, and disturbing phenomenon. And here I'm going to sound like I'm bragging, but it's actually, I say this with a bit of remorse today. I'm a graduate of Columbia and Princeton, but I've taught at Harvard and Yale. And I must tell you that there's nothing surprising about these demonstrations. These demonstrations is what they are studying in the Ivy League colleges. They're studying how to take down the United States, how to actually take down these colleges. And they're taking courses like this. This is what their faculty is drilling into their heads. And this is the outcome of a 60-year process that began in the 1960s, where the radicals tried to export their ideas beyond the university gates. They didn't succeed back then, so they went back into the campuses. They closed the gates behind them and spent the next, 4 or 5 decades instilling these ideas in students. Those students later became professors. The professors taught other students. And it goes on. You can't get tenure at half these places in the humanities unless you're a Marxist, unless you're a radical Marxist, a relativist. The field of anti-American studies, of American studies became anti-American studies, and the field of Middle Eastern studies, my field, just became the generated generations of generations of poison, not just to Israel, but to the West in general.
Yeah.
And many of these demonstrations, so many of these demonstrations are not just anti-Israel. I think anti-Israel is like the starter drug. These protests are against the United States. And now they're saying it openly, death to America, death, like echoing chants in Tehran.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising. It's not surprising at all, because coming from that place of great hatred and resentment toward the West in general, and the United States in particular, of which Israel is the outgrowth of that. And there are many factors. In addition, anti-Semitism plays a major role in this. It's even though there are some Jews involved in this, it's fundamentally anti-Semitic. I put out another statement just before Shabbat, where it turned out the Brown University, Rutgers, Northwestern, and in a deal with the protesters, said that if the protesters took down their encampment, that these universities would consider divesting from Israel. And I made an open call that if they were to consider it, that they should not receive another dollar of federal state funding, and no alumni should give them a dime. That's it, because no one's talking about divesting from China, divesting from Russia. It's totally anti-Semitic. Not only is it buckling to terror, okay, but it's also anti-Semitic by definition. And so what's going on in America on these campuses is the product of many years of systematic propaganda against the United States, teaching brainwashing against the United States. And therefore, it is a threat not just to higher education in the United States. It's a threat to the fabric of American society, and should be investigated by the FBI. How is it correcting itself? I don't know. In another Substack article published last week, I compared the situation on campuses today to what it was in 1968, and those unrest also began at Columbia, and they climaxed at the Chicago National Convention that summer of 68.
Yes.
Those of you who saw the movie The Chicago Seven, that's what it's about. You can't make this up. Of course, this summer, the Chicago National Convention is going to be in Chicago. And you can get your boots.
History doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly does rhyme, huh?
Yeah, it certainly does. Certainly does rhyme. But the big difference, those were anti-war protests. These are pro-war protests. Those protests were led by Jews. Abbie Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Mark Rudd, these are anti-Jews. This is basically the leadership of these protests are Judenrein. And people showed their face in 68. They weren't wrapped up in some type of bandanas. So it's a very difficult situation. But in the Israeli media, where I interview Alana, I said, we can't afford to ignore what's going on American campuses, because these demonstrations are going to they're going to have a gravitational effect on the Democratic Party. And we've seen it already. President Biden has been very reluctant to come out and condemn them, and then has been very qualified in his condemnation, saying, you know, saying you have a right to protest, you have a right to express yourself, but you can't attack Jews. We're already seeing that impact. Wait, just wait to see the Democratic Party platform this summer with thousands and thousands of rioters outside.
Yeah. Not only is it having an immediate impact on the Democratic Party, but just like the sort of class of 68 or the class of 72 then impacted a generation and a half later, a massive group of people, this group of people, this group, the people who are out on campuses, the people who are exposed to, you know, that syllabus, that curricula, you know, amplified by TikTok, amplified by Instagram, that's the leadership of the United States in the next generation. So, you know, how does the, you know, more sane, you know, Western minded part of the world fight against that?
Well, one hopes in the old adage, you know, if you're a socialist before you're 25, you're not a socialist before you're 25, and you should have your heart examined. If you're still a socialist after 25, you should have your head examined.
That's right.
People do grow up. They are mugged by reality, and they change their views. Depends how long, often. But there's no question about it that a generation coming out of, I think, what they call the elite universities in the United States. And those people many of them go into government, they go into the media, they go into the heads of corporations, will have an impact on the future of America's policy to the world in general. And to Israel in particular. And Israel, we have to do our best. We have to do our best to try to reveal the truth. I think there's no better way of revealing truth than bringing people here all the time. Very difficult now. Not many airlines are flying. And always to try to just diversify our foreign policy portfolio. The United States will always be our ultimate ally. There's really no substitute in the world of great powers, no other power that shares our democratic values, that shares that spiritual pillar that we talked about earlier, as well as our strategic interests. No one else does that, not the Chinese, not the Russians. But we can diversify our portfolio, and we can make ourselves far less dependent on the United States. We should be munition independent largely. And we should forge alliances with other emerging countries and parties around the world.
Okay. Who would be on the top of that list as far as you're concerned?
India.
Yeah. Let's finish off with one other element of this complex tapestry that we're all living through, which is the international legitimacy of Israel and the lawfare, the attack on Israel that's coming through legal channels. And I want to focus in on two. First is the purported threats of the ICC in The Hague, the International Criminal Court, issuing arrest warrants against the Prime Minister and other political and military leaders here for alleged breaches of international law. And on the other hand, and not to conflate the two, the Biden administration's move to sanction for the first time a part of the Israeli army, which is the Netzach Yehuda battalion. Mm-hmm. Is Israel's response to this threat adequate? And if not, what should we be doing?
Well, it hasn't never been. I was in Knesset. I headed a classified committee that dealt with very sensitive issues in Israel foreign policy. One of the issues we looked at was precisely this scenario. What happens if the ICC begins to put out warrants for the arrest of the prime minister and the foreign minister, defense minister, et cetera? And we held hearings with the various justice ministers, with the Justice Department, with the Army, and we concluded that the state was not ready for this scenario. We didn't have a requisite number of jurists who could actually defend us, and we submitted our conclusions to the government. I don't know. This is now 7-8 years ago. I don't know whether that situation has improved at all, but we're going to have to pull out all the stops because it is a serious threat. And not just the fact that the prime minister or the chief of staff can't visit Belgium, but this could also lead to far more deleterious boycotts and sanctions against us, and could, you know, has a sort of a snowballing effect.
Yeah.
Very, very dangerous. And we have to fight it and hope the United States will stand with us. And unfortunately, the United States, in a certain way, bears some of the responsibility for this because spokespeople from the administration kept coming out and saying, we're dehumanizing the Palestinians, we're killing too many Palestinians, and we're bombing indiscriminately. What is that but war crimes? And so I hope the United States now will come to our defense against this. One of the indications was the reported intention of the administration to sanction the ultra-Orthodox unit in the Israeli army, Netzach Yehuda, where when I first heard about this, I made calls to everybody I knew in the leadership of the American Jewish community and elsewhere saying, don't do this. This is a strategic threat to the state of Israel. This is not punitive. This is a strategic threat. And why? Because what begins with Netzach Yehuda ends up being with the paratroopers and with Golani, because other countries in the world are not going to focus on Netzach Yehuda. They're going to say, well, the United States did this. We can do this. And before you know it, anybody who serves in the combat unit of the Israeli army can't visit anywhere and without getting arrested. And before you know it, the parents in Israel are going to say, hey, don't go into the paratroopers, because you go into the paratroopers, you're not going to be able to visit Belgium or Britain or France or any other place. And so basically you're dealing with a strategic threat to the state of Israel. It's also a social threat, because you know, we're trying to get the ultra-Orthodox into the army. They finally get into the army and they get sanctioned by the United States. So you can imagine what the rabbis are going to be saying.
Yes.
Told you so. So made some very serious demarches, how should I say, about this. And I was happy that the administration backed down from it. They weren't going to do this. Though I received a note several days ago saying, it ain't over till it's over. In other words, it's still under consideration.
Okay. Well, on that rather sober note, I am going to wrap up what has been a fascinating discussion and really insightful. Ambassador, you've been an incredible advocate for the state of Israel before October 7th and certainly in the months and days afterwards. So thank you for that on behalf of all of us. And thank you for joining the podcast. I really appreciate
it. Always a pleasure. I'll leave you just one note. Sometimes this can seem very gloomy and reasonably, as we're here now, about to mark Holocaust Remembrance Day, and later on this week, Memorial Day for our fallen soldiers. It's going to be a very, very hard week. Even on the best of weeks since October 7th, it's difficult to see the light.
Yeah.
But I assure all of you, as a historian, and as someone who's been in this field for many years, we're going to pull through this. We've been through times, in many ways, at least as challenging. I've lived through the Yom Kippur War, and where we lost more than twice people in 3 weeks, but we've lost in 7 months. So just think that, and the population was a third of what it is today, and the economy was ruined. So we've been through tough. We'll pull through. But I'm a believer, and that helps too. But we are the most resilient. We are the toughest people on earth. We're going to be okay.
Yeah, I share the sentiments. As like you, being an immigrant to this country, I don't think I have a choice other than to be an optimist. So we will be.
We are,
be
dude.
Okay.
I am.
Okay. Thank you very much. And
thank you all. Be well.
And for those who want to hear and read more of Ambassador Oren's writings, his Substack is Clarity, and look out for more podcasts coming to you soon.
Yep.
Thanks very much.
All too. Bye.
Bye-bye.